Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. Did you know there was an official swimsuit of the Los Angeles Temple? Did you know that pioneers who came in 1847 into the Salt Lake Valley received a gold medal, including a black man who was one of the first in the pioneer company? We're going to learn more about these stories in Casey's book, 50 Relics of the Restoration. And it's going to be a fantastic conversation. Not only that, but I'm giving away a copy of this book right here. It's signed by Dr. Casey Griffiths. And so if you'd like a chance to win this book right here, sign up at gospeltangents.com/Casey. That's C-A-S-E-Y. And you could win a copy of this book here. It's a fantastic book, and it's really fun to talk about some of these amazing relics. Now back to our conversation. So let's talk about a couple of other objects in there. I'm trying to decide which one I want to go with next. How about the temple swimsuit?
The temple swimsuit. Mary Jane.
It's on the cover, isn't it?
It's on the cover. We insisted the temple swimsuit be on the cover. Mary Jane, my co-author, is the one that wrote this chapter, so she might be able to tell you a little bit more about it, but I know the basic outline. The temple swimsuit, which, like I said, those two things seem a little incongruent. This is the temple swimsuit for those of you that are out there. There was a lady named Rosemarie Reed, who was a member of the church. She grew up in Idaho and moved to Southern California, married a guy who was Jewish, and became the top swimsuit designer in the world. She ran this business where
this was in the 50s, probably?
This was in the 40s and 50s, yeah. Okay. So she designed swimsuits for Hollywood stars, for like high profile people, and was very, very well known at
Marilyn
the time.
Marilyn Monroe would have been one of them.
Uh huh, yeah. And basically, in the early 1950s, they're raising funds for the Los Angeles Temple, and Rosemarie Reed designed a swimsuit specifically to raise money for the temple. And for whatever reason, it became known by the name the Temple Swimsuit. apparently, this was so popular that someone like stole a version of it and got caught. And there was a whole scandal in the newspaper relating to it because her swimsuits were so desirable. But Rosemarie Reed eventually, you know, she had the Relief Society women in her ward sew the sequins on the suits that they sold to raise funds for it. And a couple of years ago, Rosemarie Reed's papers were donated to BYU, and they did a display of her swimsuits talk a little bit about her. We contacted BYU and said, hey, we want to take a picture of one of the swimsuits for a book we're doing, and BYU said no, like they refused. So we actually contacted the family.
Now you work for BYU.
I work for BYU.
And you have no insight?
I think it was a question of copyright, like they get nervous. I'm not criticizing Special Collections at all. They're awesome. They've always been great to work with. But we actually contacted the family. The family is up in Idaho. And they said, we have the temple swimsuit. So they had like an original of it where you could see the sequins. And just by coincidence, they were coming to Utah Valley for Thanksgiving. And so my brother-in-law, who's a object photographer, he did a lot of photography for this book. We ran over to their house. We grabbed the temple swimsuit. We stole the mannequin from BYU. We set up a photography studio in my in-law's basement. And while everybody else was upstairs eating turkey and having Thanksgiving dinner, me and my brother-in-law were downstairs taking pictures of this swimsuit.
Nice.
To where my wife's family was like, What are you doing? Like, why is there a female mannequin in a swimsuit in our basement during Thanksgiving? And exactly what's going on? And we had to say, we got the temple swimsuit. And that, again, you know, is a good conversation starter.
Exactly. I told my wife, because we had talked a little bit about the temple swimsuit a couple of weeks ago. And she's like, temple swimsuit? That doesn't even make sense.
Well, that's what it is. And like I said, it shows a time when... it shows one of those, like I said, weird areas where the history of the Restoration converges with popular culture. I mean, Rosemarie Reed is designing swimsuits for some of the most famous starlets in Hollywood. Her business eventually kind of goes away as a result of the bikini. She didn't like bikinis. Uh-huh. And she refused to design swimwear
like
that.
She was very modest.
She was very modest, but she didn't see any kind of conflict between using something like a swimsuit to promote something like the temple. And those things seem incongruous to us, but you can find connections to things like that as well. Can I bring up a couple other objects?
Yeah, absolutely. Before you do, really quickly, if it has sequins on it, can it get wet?
Yeah. I don't know. I assume so. Like I said, for a swimsuit, it's really, really fancy. And we were super, super careful with it. The family gave it to us in a Tupperware container and kind of like threatened us by death if anything happened to the temple swimsuit. But we took it. We ran with it. We got our photographs. And yeah, I think this is the first time since the 50s the photographs of that swimsuit have been openly published. And maybe the first time in color I can think of.
Yeah.
That they're out there. But as time went on, we also visited a few repositories. We worked really closely with the Church History Museum in Salt Lake, and we had some really cool experiences with them. There were people like Alan Morrill and Carrie Snow, who we came in saying, you know, we want a picture of the death masks. You know, we were doing the greatest hits. And they said, we've got a couple of things in our collection that are lesser known that maybe you should think about including as well. That could be a way to bring up some points about the history of the church that people don't always realize. Like Alan Morrill was a big proponent of the green flake medal. This is an object that's in this book that's never been photographed before, but everybody that was in the Vanguard Pioneer Company of 1847... they rounded up in 1897 at the 50th anniversary and gave them a gold medal, basically to say, this person was part of the Vanguard Company and wow, we want to recognize and honor them. Well, in the middle of those celebrations, a guy shows up at the Deseret News office, a black guy, and said, hey, I was part of the Vanguard Company too. His name was Green Flake.
Right.
And they gave Green Flake a medal and honored him as part of the Vanguard Company.
He was the one that drove Brigham Young's wagon, right?
Yeah, yeah. Green's background is fascinating. And when you dive into it, like I said, it kind of shows the complexities linked to race and the church in the 19th century. For instance, Green is a slave owned by the Flake family, the Isaac Flake family. That owns a plantation in Mississippi. And missionaries come, they convert the Flakes, and there's variance in the sources, but the general story that's told is that when the Flakes converted, they decided to migrate to Nauvoo, and they freed their slaves. But Green is 16 years old at the time, and he elects to stay with the Flakes. And at that point, there's some question as to, is he a family friend or is he a slave? Like in Nauvoo, they count tithing through labor, for instance. And the Flakes counted Green's work as tithing. Like he's their slave or something like that.
Even after he'd been
freed? Even after supposedly they had freed their slave. So there's tons of questions about, well, was Green their slave at this point? Or was Green a free person at this point? When they head west in the Vanguard Company, Isaac Flake goes and Green goes along too. Like most people sort of pass off the history of black Americans by saying, well, there weren't really any black members of the church back in the 19th century. Green is one of the first three people to enter the Salt Lake Valley alongside Erastus Snow and Orson Pratt. And so he deserves as much honor as anybody else. And then after they get to the Salt Lake Valley, the question becomes even more complicated. Isaac Flake moves to San Bernardino, California, and Green doesn't go with him, which again suggests that Green is a free man at this point. But Isaac dies while he's down there, and his widow actually sends word to Brigham Young, I need you to send Green because I can't manage the farm by myself, which suggests that Green is still seen as their property, right? They're not treating him as a slave full-time, just a slave when they need him. And at that point, Brigham Young intervenes and says, look, Green has a wife and Green has kids. He can't just pick up his life and move down there because you guys need him to, which suggests that in Brigham Young's mind, Green was not a slave. This is all in the 1850s, before slavery is outlawed, but it kind of does show that Brigham Young's attitudes towards slavery, servitude, and black members of the church was more complex than we depict it.
When you talk about the 1850s, of course, the 1852 legislature, I know Paul Reeve is coming out with a new book on that legislative session, but 1852 was when Utah legalized slavery. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so was this after?
That's a good question. And I don't know if the dates are pinned down exactly, because a lot of these are histories written by Green's descendants afterwards. Okay. That don't give a strict chronology other than in 1847, In 1847, he crossed with the Vanguard Company. The other thing that's not clear too, and there's contrary sources on, is how the Flakes treated Green. Like some sources indicate that they were really kind to him. That's why he chose to stay with them. And then there's another source where Green was speaking to an audience in Idaho and talked about how his master used to beat him. And so we're not totally clear on what the relationship was there too. Like were the Flakes, well-meaning people that existed in a system of slavery but treated their slaves relatively well, or were they cruel? Again, the sources don't really say. Now, slavery in and of itself is an inherently cruel practice, right? But we've also got to judge people in historical context and say, well, what was right and wrong to them? And Green's, we wanted deliberately to include Green's medal so that his story would be in the book so that we could raise questions about race in 19th century Mormonism.
Well, it probably wasn't illegal necessarily to beat a black person, right?
well, see, that's the thing. And I love Paul Reeve's work, and I'm anxious to see what conclusions he comes to, because one of the things that Paul has pointed out is that we tend to heap all of this burden of the priesthood restriction and racism on Brigham Young.
Right.
And Brigham Young did have racist attitudes. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And yet Brigham Young's attitude towards race was more complex than we sometimes make it be. Like Paul points out this source where at winter quarters, before the Vanguard Company left, there was a black member of the church who approached Brigham Young and basically made the statement, we have minutes of this meeting, that he knew he couldn't hold the priesthood because he was of African ancestry, that he was black. And Brigham Young in the meeting said, there's no restriction on that. He said, everybody is of one blood.
That's this is Warner McCary, 1847 in winter quarters.
Yeah. And so when I'm teaching my classes about the priesthood restriction, I bring up Green Flake. I show them the medal. I try and push back against that point that people try to make to say, well, there weren't really any black members of the church, to say there were. Here's the story of them. I also bring up Jane Manning James and how complex her story is. And then I bring in those sources from Brigham Young and from that incident that we just talked about to kind of explain how, you know, the picture is really much more complex than we make it to be. So some of these objects were intended to be conversation starters. You know, we wanted to underline the point that there have been black members of the church from the beginning, and they've served in heroic roles and have been honored in the past for the things that they've done. And we were hoping that was a way to sort of generate new discussion about the church in a way that wouldn't create that would minimally create contention. Because, you know, it's one thing to say, yeah, there was this priesthood restriction and ban. The opposite side of it, too, is that we did honor the black members of the church, especially people like Green Flake that were faithful. In last summer, in the middle of the Black Lives Matter protests, I took my kids up to Salt Lake, where Green's grave is. Mm-hmm. And there were all these complex conversations about race, and I drove my kids there, and we had a conversation on the way about race. And we're going to see the grave of a black member of the church that was there when the saints entered into the Salt Lake Valley. And I tried to introduce my children to the idea of complexity. Yeah. That really, black and white, good guys and bad guys, is never the story that the history of the church or the scriptures have presented. That it's always been flawed people doing the best that they can. And we do them a disservice when we don't do the work to try and understand the world they lived in, the context they existed in. So I'm really, really proud of the fact that that's in here. I want Green Flake's name to be more well-known and more honored in the church. And some of these black pioneers and good people like Paul Reeve are doing great work on this to get their names out there a little
Absolutely.
Bit more.
Absolutely. So just to kind of put a bow on that, we don't have any record that Green held the priesthood, correct?
No. There are black members of the church that hold the priesthood during that time. Q. Walker Lewis is ordained by William Smith. I'm blanking on his name, but Russ Stevenson, a good friend of mine, has
Elijah Abel.
Elijah Abel. Yeah, Elijah Abel holds
or Abels, as he says.
Yeah, Elijah Abel is a 70, which obviously is different back then than it is today. But there's
my dad was a 70 before they got rid of him.
Yeah, and so you kind of know how that worked and how faithful Elijah was. like I said, the racial makeup of the church is more complex than we present it as being. Because when I was a kid growing up, like, generally that was the argument that I was given, was like, hey, there weren't really any black members of the church.
Yeah.
And now we're finding out, yeah, there were.
Well, my favorite is Black Pete.
Yeah, Black Pete mentioned in the Kirtland records. Right,
1830, December 1830.
Yeah, because the main story associated with Black Pete was that he was part of kind of the religious fervor that exists in Kirtland that Section 50 of the Doctrine and Covenants addresses. And I'd heard the story with Black Pete that's typically told is that he saw a ball of light and he was chasing it and he jumped off a cliff and would have died if there hadn't been a tree below that he fell into. Well, I'd heard the story about the guy following the ball of light and jumping off a cliff, but I had no idea that he was an African-American, that he was black, and that that was part of the story too. And that the story, unfortunately, is usually told in a humorous way. Like,
yeah, like how stupid this guy is.
The connotation usually is kind of derogatory.
Right.
Which is unfortunate, and that might be why his racial background has been left out of the story from time to time. But that's part of the story too, to say, hey, as early as Kirtland, which this revelation's in 1831, a year after the church is organized, black people are part of the makeup and character of the church, and we've got to address that. We need to look at that. I mean, even the fact that the only name we know for him is Black Pete. If you go to Paul Reeves' Century of Black Mormons website and start looking at them, one of the barriers you immediately run into is the names. That if they're a freed slave, for instance, or a slave, they didn't always have a formal name. Or someone like Green Flake. I mean, his last name is literally the name of the people who owned him. Mm-hmm. And so, again, the question is, does him keeping the name suggest that there was a warm relationship between him and the Flake family? Or is it one of those things that we would say was enforced upon him? That's all complexity.
Well, I think it is pretty common for slaveholders to take their master's names.
Yeah, yeah. But again, I mean, the question is, like, did he want a different name? Or what was his background? Or how did he see his relationship with the Flake family? Those are all things that I'd love to explore a little bit deeper, and maybe we don't have the sources to. But that I would say to a person exploring this topic, just to say, hey, that's how complicated these things can be.
Yeah.
They were really, really complex human relationships, and we do a disservice when we just kind of condense it down to black and white.
And my favorite story about Black Pete, if we can just for just a minute, is that he had a vision of a black angel and that wrote him a letter, and that so he recorded that revelation.
Yeah. My friend Tony Sweat recently has done a series of paintings on the Restoration, and he painted one of the angels.
He did.
And it you know,
I got to get him on.
It caused he's a great guy, a great interview. Way before this book was written, like I'm about, I guess if you use the term orthodox, a church member as you can be. The first history that I wrote was a history of the Seminary and Institute program. But I interviewed this guy from South Africa who was a seminary teacher for the church. Uh-huh. And he talked about the question of race in South Africa, specifically that when they dedicated the Johannesburg Temple, they wanted a piece of artwork in the temple that depicted Adam and Eve as black.
Oh, really?
And this was, I mean, the Joburg Temple was dedicated in 1984, before Nelson Mandela was freed from prison while apartheid was still going on.
Right.
And for them to suggest that they put a depiction of Adam and Eve in the temple where they're black was super, super controversial. Now, the guy who suggested it, the seminary teacher, was white. His name's Don Harper. And he kept the artwork himself. It wasn't placed in the temple because I think the
so local, somebody actually painted Adam and Eve.
Yeah, someone wanted a depiction like that placed in the temple, and it turned into a big thing that the church sort of, I think, just said, we're just going to avoid this controversy.
Yeah, okay.
And set aside. But Don Harper also talked about how when Howard W. Hunter came to South Africa in the 1980s, his wife was in charge of an institute choir, and she insisted on a racially mixed choir. She said that when... In South Africa, while apartheid's going on.
Wow.
So she insisted that... She felt really strongly that when President Hunter got up to speak, she wanted a mixed-race choir behind him. And again, this is in the height of apartheid, in the middle of that acrimony that went on while Nelson Mandela is in jail. And it just shows, in a different country, race is still an issue. Obviously, it's an intense issue in South Africa, but how members of the church related to that. Like these two people, Don and Milia Harper, were very, very progressive and felt really strongly that they wanted to present to the world an image of the church in South Africa that was racially mixed. Now, I can't say that every member of the church in South Africa at the time agreed with them.
But they, sure.
They felt really strongly that they wanted their institute classes, their institute choirs, and everything they were involved with to be biracial. They wanted to move forward the two coming together. And this, like I said, is, less than a decade after the revelation on priesthood in 1978.
Well, so, and apartheid was a huge issue politically here in the U.S.
Yeah.
On how, whether we should even deal with South Africa.
Yeah. And these people, like I said, are sitting there talking about it. Then you talk with a guy named Kubulani Mletsi, who is a CES director in South Africa now, is a friend of mine. And he talks about, growing up as a black person in that society. And how the church kind of helped him reconcile with white people too. Like, he grew up genuinely angry towards white people. The church allowed him kind of a way to see and interrelate with white people and see them again as brothers and sisters and not as oppressors. So again, like I said, embrace complexity is the first thing I tell my students. I tell them the first day of class when they come in that, those simple stories of the restoration that you've been told, you weren't lied to. But there's a whole layer of complexity underneath that as an adult, you've got to learn to not only accept, but embrace. To say, hey, this is great. Like, there's more here to explore than I thought there was. And once you sort of accept that complexity is a good thing, and not necessarily something that blows your simple perceptions out of the water, church history becomes like I said, a cabinet of wonders where all the time you're finding out new stuff and you don't have to go, well, that destroys my perceptions. You go, well, that's awesome. I didn't know that. That's really neat.
I know.
Yeah.
See, that's how I am. I just love learning about these, these little tidbits, and a lot of people don't enjoy it, but they don't listen to my podcast. And it's for the people who like me that love this stuff.
To each his own, like I said, and whatever level you interact with church history and it works for you, that's okay. To me, this type of complexity, like I said, is just really uplifting. It's always got me excited.
Yeah, exactly. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Casey Griffiths. In our next conversation, we're going to talk about John Taylor's pocket watch. Was it really shot when he was there at Carthage Jail?
Because we did the Church History Museum did a similar Mythbusters sort of challenge.
Where, oh, nice.
They took a similar watch and fired a similar caliber bullet at it, and the watch just blew apart.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the watch that we have right now shows forcible damage, like it was hit by something. The gears in the watch have been driven forward through the watch face, but like it hit into something really hard. And so what some people think happened, and again, nothing settled here, is that when John was shot, he fell and he hit into the windowsill so hard that he shattered the watch.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, sign up at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and for $5 a month, you can hear the entire interview without any interruptions. If you'd like to see the whole video, that's just $8 a month, and you can sign up either at youtube.com/gospeltangents or on our website at gospeltangents.com and click the yellow subscribe button. Or you can go to patreon.com/gospeltangents, and I'll just need to make sure that we're Facebook friends, and I'll add you to our insiders group, and you can see the entire interview uncut. If you'd like to get PDF transcripts of our interviews, those are just $10 a month. And for just $15 a month, I will send you paperback versions of our transcripts as soon as they come out. Or, of course, you can buy them on Amazon as well. Go to Amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents Interview, and you can see all of our transcripts there. Don't forget to sign up for our updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Of course, you can follow us at Gospel Tangents on Twitter. To hear our interviews updated to your podcast player, go to tinyurl.com/gospeltangents, and make sure you give us a 5-star review. And of course, you should show your support for Gospel Tangents with one of these cool t-shirts, like this green one, or light blue, sport gray, royal blue, purple, of course black, beautiful gold, and of course Utah red. I've probably left out some colors, but if you want to see more, go to gospeltangents.com/shop and you can get one of these. So once again, thanks for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again.